This is Across Divides, a series of stories and experiences from communities across the island of Ireland as they meet shared challenges and consider opportunities for collaboration. Find out more at icommunityhub.org. Hello, I'm Alex McMaster, and in today's episode, we'll be looking at the role of the arts and culture as a vibrant part of civil society. We'll be speaking with three people engaged in the realms of theatre, writing and language. So I'm joined today in the studio by Paula McFetridge. Paula is the artistic director at Cabosh Theatre, an independent theatre company in the north of Ireland that's known for addressing the legacy of conflict. We're also joined by Linda Irvine, MBE. Linda is a language rights activist from East Belfast, Northern Ireland. She is the project leader of the Turris Irish Language Project, which aims to connect people from Protestant communities with their own history with the Irish language. And finally, we're joined this morning by Hilary Copeland. Hilary is the director of Fighting Words NI, an organisation providing free programmes and mentoring in creative writing and related arts to children, young adults and adults with additional needs. Hilary has also been acting director of the Irish Writers' Centre in Dublin. Thank you very much to all three of you for joining us this morning. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation. And I'd like to start off with you, Paula. The Cabosh Theatre produced a play last year, Shedding Skin, which addressed women in conflict. Could you tell us a bit more about it and how you were able to confront some really challenging topics through the play?
Yeah, as you rightly say, Cabosh is a theatre company that primarily deals with the legacy of conflict. We commission new plays from local playwrights, and often it's in partnership with voluntary groups who link us into first person narratives. We also tend to work in partnership with academics so that we can look at the legacy of projects, we can look at how we archive them, mm-hmm. we can look at how we can further study and further conversations around it. So a majority of the work deals with very, very difficult subject matter, so we need to ensure there's a package of care around it. The Shedding of Skin was written by Vittoria Gofola. It was about a 4-year project from when we initially started it, which seems like an incredibly long time. But it was because we were looking at the gaps as regards the stories that exist or have been archived as regards the impact of conflict, particularly in the north of Ireland. And I think what happens a lot when we look at conflict is we look at it from a very parochial perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important that we put conversations around pain, loss, bitterness, policing, territorial gain, colonialism, that we put that into an international context. And so one of the ways we really wanted to look at women as a tool of war and the impact of conflict on women was to put it into a global context. And so that was one of the reasons why we partnered with academics. And so as well as gathering first-person narratives from women in the north of Ireland, and primarily that came about because in 2006, the Rape Crisis Centre in the north of Ireland revealed that we had the largest number of rapes at legally held gunpoint in Western Europe. Now, as a statistic, that is horrific. But if you simply address an issue like that and you don't put it into an international context, then what happens is that the danger of re-traumatising becomes too extreme. Mm-hmm. So it's about how you allow people to see their own narratives through an international lens. So then we started looking at stories from Colombia, mm-hmm. stories about the FARC. I had met a lot of artists working with the FARC in Colombia when I was speaking at a conference in Zurich around peace building and the arts. And what they had said was that came through a lot was the relationship between male and female combatants. That for females to be reintegrated back into society was easier as mothers. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of premeditated decisions to have children so that they could be re-assimilated back in society, which again I think is really interesting. But also then I met another academic who her main area of expertise was the idea of rape as a tool of war. Mm-hmm. And so how that can happen within combatants, how that can happen from one conflict to another, how that can happen within the family unit, and the kind of different minutiae of that, mm-hmm. but also our hierarchy of sympathy. Because actually one of the things we discovered was that whenever we talk about rape and our sympathy towards victims, mm-hmm. whenever we raise the issue of combatants, people didn't have the same sympathy. And so I was really interested in how we address all those difficult issues. And so Vittoria created a really interesting play called The Shedding of Skin, which took the concept of the kind of Greek myth, mm-hmm. So it has a chorus element to it. It's performed by four actresses. And the idea of it is that they are all vessels for international stories of pain about women in war. So you put what's considered to be a parochial and a personal issue into an international global context. And unfortunately, as we all know, obviously, COVID happened. So we had to stream it initially. So we streamed it for four closed performances. We did post-show discussions. It comes with a trigger warning because it is sensitive material. But it is about celebrating survival. So we've involved a lot of music in it and a lot of, like, it's incredibly theatrical. And the brilliant thing is that the academic we partnered with, Dr. Lisa Fitzpatrick from the University of Ulster, is hosting a conference in Derry in June. Mm-hmm. And so the show is actually going to be live this year and we're going to tour it from that. It was always meant to be live. It is about creating a communal experience where we can deal with those difficult subject matters in a curated environment that is done with a connected passage of our package of care. So yeah, I mean, that's the piece. I mean, we're incredibly proud of it. Like the actors that performed it were incredible, and it's already stimulated really interesting conversations.
And I guess that kind of trait of something like theatre or other forms of art that are able to stimulate those conversations and stimulate those kind of discussions around really, really challenging topics is something that's so important when we're addressing these kind of things.
Absolutely.
After they've happened or even during they've happened. And these are also situations that are constantly evolving and changing and discussions that are constantly changing around them.
And they're human experiences. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing about it. And like once you hear something about something, you can't unhear it. Yeah. You know, so it's this idea that if you bear witness to something, that then it will challenge people. Yeah. So they can't just dismiss it. They have to create an informed opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really interesting about those kind of informed, animated experiences that are catalysts for change. And I think theatre and the work that we all work in has great potential to do that.
Yeah. That kind of experience, Hilary, your organisation, Fighting Words, helps provide access to the arts. How has that been able to, I guess, give people those kinds of experiences of the arts and allow them to deal with these kinds of topics or discussions?
So all of the activities at Fighting Words are offered for free at the point of access to children and young people. And at Fighting Words and I, we work all across the north. I'm also very fortunate we have a sister organisation based in Dublin called Fighting Words, and they have dozens of Fighting Words locations all across the island. So we're two different companies. We are working in two different jurisdictions, but we're also working in partnership and we're sharing loads of learning. I've been so grateful to sort of be able to experience that. Sometimes, having previously worked in the north in the arts, I had a tendency to be quite insular or to be quite internal looking and get quite caught up in the complexities of operating in the north. And having another organisation who are operating from the Republic of Ireland has been great for me. I also brought to my two Fighting Words and I my experience of working for the Irish Writer Centre in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And that was such an eye-opening experience for me because I had to pay attention to what I didn't know about the island that I lived on. So I moved to Dublin and I was working in, as I mentioned, a different jurisdiction, a different government, a different way of operating sort of at a systems level. Mm-hmm. And I realised that there was so much I didn't know. I had to pay attention to TDs and who were the ministers and who was everybody talking about.
Yeah.
And then I realised that for years I had been complaining that in Northern Ireland, people just don't understand us here and it's so complex and nobody's really, you know, paying attention to the intricacies of our government. And then I realised I was also part of that problem. So I've been very fortunate, I find, to have that sort of broader perspective. And it really led to me asking questions of myself about what did I know or not know about living on the island of Ireland. And I've learned so much about that in terms of the value of narrative experience, being able to put words to one's own experience. And Paula, I know that you've, at Kabosh, have always worked about this, the idea of giving voice, but also understanding that it's not about positioning the work that in the arts that we're doing, which is letting somebody speak. It is about those voices are speaking, those people are articulating their experience, and really all I'm doing at Fighting Words is I'm facilitating that. And one of the great pieces, the sort of the ethos of working at Fighting Words is we're encouraging children and young people to be the artists.
Yeah.
We're providing them with the skills, the tools, the building blocks of storytelling. So that's incredibly important, because that is not necessarily the focus in the curriculum or in the classroom, but also in terms of much broader than education. It's about life experience and being able to have those tools as they progress through life, to not just only articulate their thoughts, their views, but sense of self, independence, idea of dialogue and engaging in kind of conflicting ideas. That's really important to have all of those tools as a young person. Just sets you off in terms of life and what you need to work as a functioning adult in civic society.
And I guess that kind of engaging in dialogue and having those kind of discussions and experiences, language is a completely central part to that. And so, Linda, I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about the work that you do in terms of language and how that might be able to broaden experiences or perspectives for people.
Well, I think the work we've been doing over the past 10 years it's changed the narrative, really, about the Irish language. And that's not what we started off to do. You know, we started off because we loved the language. We got involved in the language. Other people wanted to join us. I think the greatest thing about it is very cross-community orientated. And we didn't start off to be cross-community. We started off to, I suppose, give people within the unionist community an opportunity to engage with the language, because historically they hadn't really. That had been difficult for them. But, you know, being what we are and what we do, we were keen not to, I suppose, create a sort of a project where we're taking it back.
We just
wanted to be part of what was going on. And we've always encouraged our learners, in fact, physically taken them over into West Belfast or other places where the language is on offer. And it's created, I suppose, a very natural cross-city engagement where people come over to us, we go over to them. We have, you know, so many relationships, friendships. We even had a couple of marriages and a baby. So, you know, it's kind of all happening. But, you know, it's been a very positive place to be. And, you know, we get criticism for what we do. We have people who stand outside and misunderstand what we're about. But, you know, we love the language. That has grown into, you know, tourism, a whole sort of history project. And now we have our own NISCL, our own Irish language nursery school. We are both integrated and Irish medium. And for us, that has... It has been really, really difficult. It's surprising how, you know, over the last 10 years, Turris has become really accepted by, I suppose, the community on the local Newton Arch Road. It's only a very small number of people who, you know, kind of attack us on social media. And yet, when we started to open, we tried to open a NISCL for 16 three-year-olds, we were met with, you know, an online hate campaign, with protests and all sorts of threats. And I still find that difficult to get my head around what is the issue about that. We've now been going for 6 months, thankfully, in a temporary building, and we have to move at the end of June. And we're not finding it easy to find an alternative location because, again, you know, people are nervous. And I think 23 years after the Good Friday Agreement, it's not acceptable. It's just not acceptable. So I feel very much the work we do, we're at the coalface, but the work we do does change things. It does bring people on board. You know, we have people who volunteer for us, people who are our learners who, you know, 7 or 8 years ago are attacking us on social media or, you know, so attitudes do change. And, you know, tourists means journey. And the organisation that I formed, and I see people are on a journey, you know.
That's quite a transformation, I suppose. And how do you actually, I guess, address those kinds of challenges and conflicts in a constructive manner that has then that positive outcome? Because obviously you've succeeded so much in that way in overcoming the barriers that were, you know, really already there and that were so I guess, ingrained and entrenched in culture and in tradition. How is it that you've been able to kind of overcome those?
Well, I think it's a work that I'm still doing. So I can't say that I have overcome it. I'm working to overcome it. I suppose one of the first things when I got involved in the language and started learning Irish, and, you know, with no plan or no conception of what lay ahead, I was amazed. You know, I had an idea of what the language was all about, who the language belonged to, and it didn't put me off learning it, but I had these preconceived ideas, which of course were wrong. And when I started to learn about the language, you know, I remember being really shocked, you know, the fact that it was in our place names and our surnames. I mean, you know, I was born and brought up, I've spent my whole life in Belfast, but I didn't know it was Belfastshire. And, you know, something so basic that you didn't have access to that knowledge. So, you know, the more I learned, the more frustrated I felt. And I also recognised that other people felt like me. They wanted to get involved in the language. I wanted to share it with them. So I come from a teaching background, so I created a big PowerPoint with all the information that I had discovered and went out to sort of deliver that to groups. And, you know, I've spoken to thousands of people over the last 10 years, and I've sat, you know, and I've watched people go from, you know, hostile faces to disbelief to acceptance and engagement and saying, well, you know, when can I learn? Why did I never know that? And men especially, working class Protestant men, who'd say, why were we never told that? Or if I'd have known this about the language, I wouldn't have an issue. Because, you know, for them, the only Irish they know is Chucky Arla. And let's face it, that's not going to win you round if you're from the PUL community. And when you say to them, you know, that is, you know, that's not to deny certain parts of the history of the language. I'm not about censoring information. But it's about showing that it's a small slice of a much bigger cake and that, you know, it belongs to us all if we want to embrace it. So I find so much interest within the unionist community from people who want to be part of the language, who want to learn it, who want to engage with it. And of course, it's not easy to learn a language. But, you know, some of them are really determined. We now have 9 people at university. So for me, education is the key. Knowledge is the key. And in Northern Ireland, you know, we're fed on, I suppose, both sides of our divided community. We're fed a very narrow idea of what history was all about. We don't get the nuances. We don't get the complications.
I suppose that kind of access to information and that kind of education is something that is really central to what you're doing as well, Hilary. And I wondered to what extent the work that you've done both in the Republic of Ireland and in Northern Ireland has kind of influenced the way that you approach, you know, helping people to get that kind of access to whether it be information or a platform for discussion or access to, you know, for art forms that perhaps they wouldn't have had access to before.
So I suppose the ethos of Fighting Words Northern Ireland has been shaped by operating in a post-conflict environment. The segregation in our school systems, that idea of culture and identity belonging solely to some people and then being shut off to other people, you know, is always here in the environment we're all working in. So we... it sort of shaped our programmes. It really, as a very young charity, and we're sort of still very early days in our evolution, but it became, you know, a really critical element of our first ever strategic plan, that we knew that cross-community working across communities was going to be a really significant part of our work. And that has shaped some of the work that we have done working with schools and bringing schools together on projects. But also as our team grow and develop, the conversations that we're having as an organisation internally, I think, are really important too, about the kind of work that we want to do and how we can best make our activities and programmes available to as many children and young people as possible. And we know that that involves looking at other forms of division, so geography and regional divisions, rural locations, and that's something that our sort of partners in Dublin with Fighting Words have done really well. There is a Fighting Words in Connemara that is in Irish, that is operating there. And that was something that bespoke, that sort of came out of the environment and what the people in, locally in Connemara really wanted. Mm-hmm. So Fighting Words was a conduit to that. And that's what I would love to see us do in the North, is that we're responding to needs in communities, and what are, we're also a very volunteer-centred organisation. So our volunteers shaping more of what we do, as well as then getting children and young people to tell us, this is what I would like to see in my school, in my community group, in the area that I live in. And what we can do then is bring those maybe disparate parts together through activities. For me, education that allows young people from lots of different backgrounds to learn together is really key to, mm-hmm. to peace building mm-hmm. In this part of the world. And I believe that not only because, as Linda said, some of those histories are closed off or not necessarily shared as widely as they can be, but also because I think children and young people are, we need to give them more credit. They are, you know, the formers of their own thoughts. When you put them in a room together, they learn from each other. I went to an integrated school and I learned anything I ever knew about GAA from the young people in my class. I did not know anything about GAA before that, but because I had friends who, you know, would tell me, well, this is who I support, and oh no, we're not playing against them. You know, it was great mm-hmm. learning for me. But that learning is not just top down. It's not just from a teacher. It is young people learning from each other. Yeah. And I know that yeah. across the island, that is really key. It's the sharing of stories, which allows young people to share their experience mm-hmm. as well as listen to each other and learn mm-hmm. from each other.
Like, it's also the ability, but to be responsive and strategic. So I think so often that we undervalue the concept of being able to be responsive, because I think all of us have been working in our fields for quite some significant time. We have a lot of volunteers that work with us all. We have various networks. So being afforded to have that flexibility where you can respond to need or meet demand, I think it's something that we underestimate. I also think that very often we talk about the need to do cross-community work and the need to do trans community work and like transgenerational work, but I also think that that doesn't mean we need to stop doing single identity work, because I think, I mean, as you rightly say, Linda, as well, I mean, a lot of the work that we do, that now what tends to happen is that we see single identity work as being not as progressive, mm-hmm. you know, because there are inevitably certain communities and certain sectors of our society that are not at the point of doing the cross community. And so often what I find still happening is that if we don't manage to keep the single community and the cross community running simultaneously, we are leaving communities behind. And I think that the reconciliation or the informed discussions are very thin. It's not a deep engagement, and it's not something that necessarily would last long term. And so my concern would be that then all that does is just suppress any degree of ignorance or sectarianism or lack of knowledge. And it eventually then will ripple to the surface again. And that's then when you go back to concepts of cycles of violence or concepts of cycles of oppression. And I think that's something that always kind of needs to be considered as well, you know.
Yeah, I think that's really important, that peace building or reconciliation isn't about neutralising or some kind of, like, you know, the edges honed off version of identity mm-hmm. Or religion or culture. It's actually mm-hmm. the affirmation that comes from
Absolutely.
Looking at oneself and looking at where you've come from and all the elements that have formed that. And that identity is so multiplicitous, you know,
it's fluid
yeah, and changing identity yeah. I think that's something that maybe we as a society haven't quite caught up with. Mm-hmm. Your identity mm-hmm. is rigid and fixed, but actually, you know, mm-hmm. choose it on day-to-day basis can be much more freeing.
Sometimes I have concerns with some of the stuff that I've been involved with myself as a participant, not as a you know, somebody leading it, that some of the cross-community work that I've seen focuses a lot on difference and unnecessary difference and creates difference. And it's almost like to tick the boxes, it has to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways in Northern Ireland, we've created an industry out of that. And that I find very, very worrying. Mm-hmm. And I feel, you know, in some ways, a lot of the way forward. And I think that's what we have managed to do unintentionally is, you know, we haven't tried to bring 10 Catholics, 10 Protestants together. We're not interested in that. We've just offered something and we've said, you know, come. And because of what we offer, it attracts people from both sides of the community who then sit down together, they learn together, they laugh together. Genuine friendships and relationships are formed. And, you know, you talked about risks, Paula. You know, we've been flexible, we've taken risks, we've said, well, you know, why wouldn't we do this? Why shouldn't we do this? Why can you not do this? Don't tell us you can't do this. Of course we can do it. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a go. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, you know. And I think, unfortunately, in Northern Ireland, again, you know, there's a lot of what you've maybe called gatekeepers who say, no, communities would never stand for this. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, we can't do that. Well, you know, stop vilifying communities and telling communities what they won't stand for. Why don't you give them an opportunity?
Yeah, we've so many quangos, so many gatekeepers. It's ludicrous.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole kind of relationship between church and state is still so rigid. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have so many party political barriers actually put in place. Like, we find that all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that an awful lot of the really progressive work that's actually really creating change within culture is coming from grassroots up, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we're fortunate in that the three of us do work with those communities. Yeah. Yeah. But I think so often that the same conversations are having to happen because they're not being listened to.
I feel very strongly that some of the bureaucracy of peace building that isn't operating on the systems level in Northern Ireland is really self-defeating. Linda mentioned box ticking, and I think that, you know, it can be very frustrating when you're engaging with grassroots communities and listening to communities talk about what they need to then implement a monitoring or evaluation form that is asking, you know, 11-year-olds, have they changed their opinion on nationalist unionist identities. That is very, very difficult. And I am very conscious that as a salaried arts worker, I'm part of a process that is implementing that difference when what I'm trying to do is, and at a philosophical level, is really try and upend that. And I would love to see the decision makers and at a government or a local authority level, those people who are putting those funding projects in place, be able to engage with the people who are the recipients or clients and saying, we need to look at that in a different way.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
because the excuse always is that, you know, it's because we don't see the work that we do as business-led. You know, like, we know the value of putting public money into the work that we do. We're absolutely prepared to quantify and qualify impact. Mm-hmm. But I completely agree with you. The number of communities that will say to us, like, we spend so long going, let's not talk about polarised identity. And then the first question you ask them is, do you consider yourself to be off this community?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean,
and Hilary made a point about the evaluation, and I mean, some of it I see as ludicrous at times, you know, the kind of questions that you're meant to ask and the way you're meant to assess, you know, the impact of your maybe one-off talk. You know, did you walk in here with, you know, your thought black, but now you're going out white? And yeah, that does happen. But, you know, is that a good way to evaluate things? You know, don't things take time? Don't people take time to, you know, think about things, rethink things, to work things out rather than, you know, there's an hour session and I'm away and I'm a new
and
person.
That's
absolutely,
yeah.
You know,
it's like mass baptism,
and it's a wonderful way for funders to be able to say, "Oh yeah, there we go." You know, work's done. But as we know in Northern Ireland, when we look 23 years after the Good Friday Agreement, no, the work is not done. The work is not done. It's very much a work in progress, and you know, all those tick box forms aren't just not going to cut it. You know,
no, I think it infantilizes people. It's sort of, you know, to say that your mind will be changed from this hour long experience or one of our 2 hour workshops. Uh-huh. I mean, I would love to say that, but I'm not going to wave a magic wand and make that happen.
No.
and I think it also diminishes, you know, the cultures and the sense of self that someone is bringing to an engagement. If that's a play, if that is a class, if it's a workshop, whatever art form they're engaging in, you're bringing your whole self and all of your experience to that. Mm-hmm. So why would I have the audacity to think that my 2 hour creative writing workshop is going to entirely change somebody's position on anything?
But it also undervalues the impact of the conflict. You know, I mean, even on a simple basis where you go, you cannot go through a 35, 40 year war and be fixed in an hour. You know, if fixed, like, it's actually the idea, you know.
And I suppose even the forms themselves, you know, when somebody's confronted with that, you know, how does that make them feel? You know, if I haven't changed my mind, you know, am I in the wrong? Am I, you know, you know, what position am I meant to take here? Sort of thing. It almost sets them up to feel.
And like people will say to us, I'm really sorry, but will you get your funding stopped if I don't answer really well on this?
You pass or fail on peace building.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, I mean, the changing demographics of Northern Ireland, you know, is something that comes up quite a lot, but there's nearly a gatekeeping that is being implemented. If you're looking at this form and you're going, well, I don't really identify as a unionist or a nationalist or as a Protestant or Catholic or some other kind of white Eurocentric Christian hegemonic identity, if you fall any way outside of that, where is your place in this concept of Northern Ireland? Because that's what we're saying over and over again. Counts.
Even with the integrated sector, this is one of the things that we're sort of looking at, because we are part of the integrated sector. It's traditionally 40-40-20, but the wonderful thing is the others are rising. You know, the others are more than the 20%, and we see it, you know, even in our work. So many people, they actually, and I feel embarrassed now when we have to ask the question because of our funding, because they, well, why do you want to know, you know? And I don't want to tick one of these boxes. And I think that's brilliant. They don't want to be put into a little narrow box. But unfortunately, the way the setup is, we have to get them into Catholic, Protestant or other, you know, where do you self-define?
Other is doing an awful lot of hard work there. I mean, other is a really broad brush stroke.
But even the other, we have to look in the other and say, well, are you a Protestant other or a Catholic other?
But then, like, you still have to hit your targets. I mean, that is the ridiculous thing. Like, we're still talking about peace money being divided on that basis of the 40-40-20. You know, which is crazy, because then you spend your whole time running around the north looking for certain people.
And yet the reality is, because the others are rising, shows the benefit of the work that we're all doing.
Absolutely.
Because people are saying, no, sorry, not signing up to that. I'm not one or the other. I want to be another.
And we can all talk about change we've witnessed. I mean, that's the other thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when it comes to kind of personal narratives or stories or the use of language or culture or even communications that we've all had, I mean, the change is palpable. And it actually just shows you what actually is possible, you know. But, yeah.
Like, I suppose when you're, I mean, you're looking there at what's kind of often been regarded as a very rigid and fixed set of identities, but the work that all of you are doing is kind of looking at identity perhaps as more fluid. I'm wondering how these kind of mixing of identity, you know, you talked about them as individualistic, you know, individual identities, but also the importance of that alongside also crossing the divides between identities.
Yeah, but and it's also about bearing witness to the rigid. You know, so also in the same way where you go, okay, the identity that potentially we don't necessarily understand, because say, for example, it is, like we did a piece about policing that was based on an oral archive that was gathered from Garda Síochána and RUC officers that patrolled the border during the height of the conflict. Now, that is two, you know, it seems on paper, polarised opposites, okay? But there's an awful lot of people that would not want to engage with that narrative. But there's no point in us creating a fictional version of that narrative. It is about bearing witness to the narrative as the person who owns it or sees themselves as possibly part of that community, wants themselves to be represented. And so it is about also allowing those very distinct identities to exist so that we can have informed conversations, because that then informs the conversations rather than actually censoring something and presenting it back in a neutralised, safe package. It is about like informed provocations that change the debate.
Yeah, fighting words and I, what we're trying to do is encourage young people to develop their confidence and their imagination and to engage in creativity and to have fun. I mean, so often that's sort of way, way down at the bottom of the list of an ask that, that somebody who may be, you know, funding or supporting a project might put in. But that is all because we believe that all of those elements help develop a well-rounded individual. So the cross-community work is it's a soft approach, I suppose we could say to that, that all of these elements that we're really hoping that we can see and we do see come out of the young people who engage in our activities is that they will be more confident in team building or in a collaborative exercise, that they have the confidence to write on their own and to stand up in a group and talk about something that they've just created in the space of 40 minutes and a story that they've invented and part of that they've built themselves as a group together. Mm-hmm. That's so encouraging for us. We love to see over the course of a 2-hour session sort of like a reticence turn to joy and fun, and that's something that's engaging. That's the change that we see. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of different programs that our aim is that young people will then be encouraged as they grow older to tap into that ability, that they will be able to have all the skills needed to be contributing to their society. Young people they're so much more political than I remember being, mm-hmm. Political with a small p, mm-hmm. that they're much more attuned to what's going on in the world. They want to talk about gender equality, they want to talk about trans rights, they want to talk about the climate crisis. That's part of what they are already talking about, whether they were engaged in a Fighting Words workshop or not. And we are just giving them the tools to be able to do that.
And then it's the ripple effect of that. Then they have new conversations when they go home. They have new conversations in the classroom. They have new conversations on social media with their friends. It's better informed. And then you have other young people then that go and see the work. And then they become ambassadors for it. And it's the ripple effect of these kind of collective actions that we all do. The thing that gets underestimated, and that also is very difficult to quantify, mm-hmm. Because I think that's when we use the word participants. What we mean is those that engage in the workshops, those that live with these people, mm-hmm. somewhere else, because that changes the conversation, those who originally inspired the project or who donated their story to be part of it, those who work with us as the community gatekeepers, those who hosts the workshops or the performances that we do, all of them to a certain degree are participants in the practice. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes gets underestimated as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're working with children and young people, but also with their parents, their guardians, their carers, their teachers, the environment that they all operate in, their youth club leaders and, mm-hmm. and after school leaders in the youth clubs that they're in. Like there's a whole connection here, that there's no one who's coming to one of our activities who's coming alone.
Yeah, well, I can relate very much to that in our classes, because people come and, and I've seen it change so much even over the years. At first, the ones from the PUL community, a lot of them were very frightened. They didn't want neighbours or friends or sometimes even family members knowing that they were learning Irish. And, if journalists come in or photographs were taken, they left the room. And, now they're wearing the T-shirt and they're bringing the friends and the neighbours and the family members along. The people, maybe who came over from, say, West Belfast or something. I remember one story in particular, one man, he came and, he did a sort of a recce of the building. He drove around it 3 times. He was really nervous. He saw the murals at the bottom of the Newton Arts Road. And, and I can understand why he was feeling intimidated. He'd never been in this part of East Belfast before. And then he came in and we have a beautiful mural which kind of talks of, the fact that the language is bilingual. Mm-hmm. And he got a cup of tea and he realised we don't eat our young, and he stayed, Mm-hmm. So it's those sorts of experiences that I think are wonderful, as we make new friends. But I'm also very aware that everybody who comes, and I see it very much now, they make the decision they're going to come and learn Irish. They don't come from a background, they don't come from a tradition where Irish is seen as being something that you do. But all of a sudden, they're really engaged with it, and they're on social media or they're telling their friends and they're saying, my husband can't understand it, but I'm teaching him a couple of words, and actually Lindy was really interested when I told him about such and such. So, It has, as Paula said, it has that ripple effect, that it's changing the idea of who speaks Irish and who is an Irish speaker. I look at our children in the Nice School, and the majority of our parents, interestingly enough, some of them are just Protestant, some of them are just Catholic, but the majority of them are mixed marriages. Mm-hmm. So, if mommy's a Protestant, then there's Protestant grandparents, or if daddy's a Protestant, there's Protestant grandparents on that side. Mm-hmm. And you can see when we do events, it's a bit of a walk on the wild side for them. But this is their, this is their treasured grandchild. And, within a short time, they're really proud of the fact this child's going to have 2 languages, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because it is all about bearing witness to something that's different. Absolutely. Or is like perceived to be different.
Yeah.
And actually breaking down the whole idea of being afraid of it.
Yeah. And that's hard when you're the kind of trailblazer. Yeah. And it's even harder when you've got a 3-year-old involved. And I get that, But It's only by doing that, and we've seen it in tourists, it's only by doing that, it's only by putting your head above the parapet that anything changes. Mm-hmm. Because if you keep agreeing with the status quo, or if you keep saying, oh no, we can't do that because somebody mightn't like it, or, you know, nothing will change in Northern Ireland. You mm-hmm. know, you have to take risks.
Mm-hmm. I suppose you kind of, it's very similar to what Paula was saying about that kind of ripple effect, what you were describing about, you know, that kind of intergenerational effect, and also bringing in other members of family or friends and kind of engaging them. And I wondered, because you also mentioned, you know, people coming over from West Belfast as well, and I wondered for all of you to what extent your audiences have changed through time, and not just in the sort of traditional sense, but also, you know, between ages and between people from a whole host of different backgrounds, whether that is something that has changed.
I think for us, yeah, it has just broadened. I mean, when we started 10 years ago, we were very small. We were, I think, you know, probably 99% Protestant, mm-hmm. very local East Belfast. And, you know, over the years it's grown. We're still, the majority of our learners come from East Belfast. They're all age groups, they're all different classes. In fact, you know, I look around a room sometimes and there's somebody sitting there who has a PhD, somebody sitting that doesn't have a GCSE to their name. And I think, you know, where would these people even meet together socially? You know, it just wouldn't happen. And yet, you know, they're all, the language is a great kind of evener. So they're all struggling, you know, and they're all encouraging each other. And, you know, and they do lovely things, like when we do the Fun Yarrigids or something, you know, it's a wee thing you do for your badge, a wee bit of language study. You know, they've invited each other to their houses and made meals and shared it and gone to the Gaeltacht together. So, you know, it's just those friendships have been amazing. But the cross-community element, were again, that we don't focus on, is just people getting together. You know, we have people there from all sorts of backgrounds, security force backgrounds, paramilitary backgrounds, just all sorts of things. And I think of one story in particular where a man who's dead now, he was ex-RUC who had been shot during the Troubles and who was very frightened of coming, but ended up, you know, we became his only social life. And so many stories of healing, I suppose.
Our programmes are partly shaped by the young people who engage with them. So we work across a number of genres. We've done script writing, play writing, performing on stage. During the pandemic, everything sort of had to change really radically. And what was a theatre making program became a radio plays program. And we've also, you know, fiction and journalism. And really, it's about whatever those young people want to engage in. So, you know, even if you think about social media, which so many young people are really engaged in, that's an element of storytelling. And critical thinking is a really important skill as well, that, you know, particularly with our journalism club, it was an opportunity to get young people to be thinking a little bit about what are they absorbing from the world, what are they putting back out into it, mm-hmm. and making those assessments, which I think is increasingly vital mm-hmm. in the world that we're in. But ultimately, it sort of always comes back to storytelling. It's just a different kind mm-hmm. of a storytelling, or a different platform for storytelling. Mm-hmm. A brilliant piece of feedback, which was one of my favourites, from a young person from a post-primary workshop, said that when I walked in, I didn't know how to write a story. And when I walked out, I knew I could. Mm-hmm. And that's so powerful for me, the potential of what that means and what you can do with those skills. We have a huge number of volunteers who work with us, and our volunteers are gold dust. We couldn't run our activities without them. And they come from a whole broad range of backgrounds as well. And, you know, whether it's whether the minimum they can contribute is an hour or 2 hours a year, or they're regulars who want to come back week to week, that's another opportunity for us mm-hmm. to engage with people and for them to tell us what's going on with their lives. And we're building a community from those people as well, mm-hmm. who are telling us what's happening and how they can see the work that they're doing with us and the change that they see in those young people as well.
Mm-hmm. You've all mentioned, you know, engaging with young people and that kind of, I guess, intergenerational and transgenerational engagement. And I suppose that when we've looked a lot at kind of conflicts that still have a legacy now, but there are also new challenges constantly coming up all across the island. And you know, we mentioned earlier, I think that Hilary, you mentioned earlier, the kind of spreading beyond the urban sphere with your work and trying to reach rural areas, and you talked about Connemara, and I suppose that kind of rural-urban divide or challenge, it has existed for a long time, but it's something that's bringing up new challenges all the time, and not just there, but you know, in all kinds of aspects of society across the island, there are constantly new challenges and they're evolving. And I just wondered how the arts and culture kind of are evolving in tandem or in parallel with those challenges, and how they can kind of be a medium of addressing those challenges in the way that you've all described that they address past or legacy challenges.
Mm-hmm. Paula, I think, touched on this when you said about being strategic and responsive, and I think that's something we've all sort of had to do, but mm-hmm. also have become a little bit skilled at. And that awful word that everyone used and during the pandemic, which to pivot, which is taking what you maybe had traditionally done and do that in a new way. So when we moved our creative writing workshops onto an online platform, that really helped us, you know, ask ourselves questions about, well, you know, what are the barriers that people had to taking mm-hmm. part in a physical workshop in our mm-hmm. space, which is based in Skeynas on the Newton Ards Road as well. If you didn't have a bus fund or your school was just too far away, then, and we are really listening to schools, particularly who are telling us about the challenges that they're facing and the challenges with budgets that they're dealing with. So we have always want to have in-person work. We always want to have that face-to-face time. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that perhaps is not spoken about as much as the world is now talking about remote learning and remote working, which is mm-hmm. the work that all of us are involved in and so many other community groups and organisations are involved in, is about bringing people together. And you get so much when you can do that in person. But it has also made us ask questions and have to think about who's not able to do that, or who are the people who their circumstances, their, you know, at different times of life means that that's not possible. And so other platforms, remote learning or things, asynchronous learning is something that particularly we have a Write Club, which is for teenagers, an after school club. And there's an element of that which is on our websites, they can write stories, they can post stories, get peer feedback. Our volunteers will help kind of editing and safeguarding that platform. That's something that can be done not in person. And it means that our activities have really broadened in scope and got over one of those barriers, which is geography. Not everyone's able to come to us all the time.
Mm-hmm. We have an online thing called Streets of Belfast that actually was a... We worked with political tours both on the Falls Road and on the Shankill Road, mm-hmm. where we worked with local historians and with local ex-combatants who were doing political tours anyway, mm-hmm. for like as part of kind of a tourism drive. And we created live shows. But then what happened was we turned those into digital apps so that those who were not at a point in their lives where they felt safe to either go onto those roads and hear the narratives firsthand, or else were living somewhere else so they wanted to experience it from the comfort of their own sofa, or else as part of an educational tool where they could hear first person narrative, which had a fictional element to it to put it into context. We made those into digital apps, and then what happened was last year Tourism NI funded us to create a portal on our website where you can do those tours where they're told by the combatant, but also you get short plays along it, you get further reading, you get links to local universities, to local libraries, to academic reports, to photographs of the locations pre and post. So that whole idea of how we put our contemporary culture into an historical context, mm-hmm. I think is really important. That's a lot of the work, you know, that obviously Linda does with language. Mm-hmm. But the other thing as well is there are incredible community initiatives across the island. Like, there's an amazing festival in Cork called the Fit Up Festival, which is based on the old style Irish fit ups, where you pop up and you turn up on a community centre and you get two lights and a floor and a table and you do your show. And we've done it on the islands off West Cork. And they do the East Cork Festival called the Blackwater Festival in February each year. And then you do the islands and West Cork in July, August. Mm-hmm. And it's tiny portable shows where you do a different venue every night. And each of the small rural communities all around that area get to see or have a choice of six shows over a 4-week period. Mm-hmm. And they're all like €3 at the door. And it's brilliant. It's run by a local guy called Jeff Gould. And it's quality work that's going down. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think like a lot of the work that we would tend to do, we create it in a way that it can play theatres and non-theatres, can play in the heart of communities. But as Hilary says, we've all pivoted fairly well, actually. You know, like, we're doing a lot of online stuff. We've had to record a lot of stuff. But the live communal experiences can still not be underestimated. I mean, you know, also, you know, there is technology poverty out there as well. And so we've tried to support young people and community groups so they could get access to the work. And then also we're doing an arts and older people project in care homes about gardening that also looks at the concept of touch and taste and smell and senses and the conflict and all that, that will also be able to be done virtually by leaders on an ongoing basis. So, yeah.
And we've had a similar experience when COVID first came, then we had to change. All our classes were live. This was a really different thing for us. And also, I suppose it really increased our sense of community, because we weren't just classes that could stop or just simply go online. We were a community who had to keep in touch with each other and support each other. And, you know, some of our older people, you know, didn't know how to work the technology. Some of them were able to transition over to that, but not all. We also set up a sort of a buddy system where we put people into twos and small groups of threes, and they supported each other with telephone calls, with meeting up whenever they were able to later on for little walks and chores together, or just online chores. And the lovely thing about that has remained, and they have stayed really firm friends and now come in small groups. We also then invested in new technology, and we're in the lucky position now where we're able to live stream certain classes. So we have an audience in front of us, we've class participants, but we've also got class participants online. And as Hilary said, something that I hadn't given a lot of thought to, you know, we have people who, you know, now who are from Northern Ireland or other places, who are tuning in from, you know, England and all sorts of places, or rural areas, or they're disabled, or they're not able, you know, some people who maybe do shift work, or they're at home with the children, or they're home looking after, you know, elderly parents or things like that. But they're able not to have to miss the classes, so that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, I suppose before we were very sort of focused in on, here's the people that are in front of you, that's what you focus on, but now you can really widen that experience. It also made us, because we'd been nearly, you know, well over a year to kind of start focusing more on you know, online resources that we were able to send out to people, and to think a lot more about that. How do you help people to engage? How do you support them in their learning now that you don't see them in front of you? There's a lot more work to do. So I think in many ways it really helped our teaching and helped us to support our learners.
You've all mentioned kind of that importance of doing grassroots work and working up from the bottom. And I wonder to what extent your work has benefited from collaborating with other community groups and other actors within at the kind of community level.
Very much so. I mean, all of our projects, we have community partners who work with an organisation called the Diversity Challenges. He basically gathered all the story of the policing that then inspired the play that we created, Green and Blue. For example, we're currently working with Women's Aid on a project looking at domestic violence. We're working with the PSNI on a project about domestic servitude. I mean, they would be obviously like a more umbrella organisations, but also then you have projects like the Peace 4 projects we've done in County Louth, where we're working with places like Bush Post Primary, just outside Drogheda. We're working with people like the Glen Centre down in Manor Hamilton, doing projects all around the border, where actually they then become ambassadors for the project. And so they become... it's weird because they start off as gatekeepers, but inevitably then what they become is our kind of buddies, and that they then do the introductions. And they are the ones that make it easier for us to connect and actually do the work that matters, I suppose. No, I mean, the work's not possible without various community partners who are operating within very different sectors and that also have the ear of the communities that are hardest to reach. I mean, we found that particularly, like, we did a project based on stories we gathered from recent Somalian migrants. And if we hadn't been working with people, particularly within the community in East Belfast, we wouldn't have got to the heart of what the stories were. And then similarly, we couldn't have connected with that group to make them... to ensure the piece was authentic, and so it had the impact it had, you know.
Yeah. And again, we're similar. You know, we've over the years, my goodness, I just hundreds of different groups who invite us in or, you know, come to us. And, you know, some of them that we would have very close working relationships with, some of them would be one-off or, you know, just a few times working with. People within church groups, community groups, language groups, schools, all sorts of different ones. Mm-hmm. But it's that that enriches your work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I suppose we all have the same sort of aim. You know, we want to do something positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I know with the various Fighting Word locations that are based around in the Republic of Ireland, so many of those were volunteer led or adopted, and with the support of a centralised team in Dublin, then they went through safeguarding, went through different techniques, approaches, in order to set those up in their own communities. And that could be at a community centre or at a library or, you know, in a workshop in a local theatre. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is really important to us as well at Fighting Words NI. We'd love to see that as part of our big mission and big plans, or to set up a number of locations all around the north. And just last autumn, we got a new member of the team. We were really grateful for Reconciliation Fund funding allowed us to do that, and that was part of that role, was to move outside of Belfast, where a lot of our work had been centred, and work all across the north, and make those connections with community groups or sports clubs or after school clubs, and be able to respond to some of the needs that are there. And maybe it's different age groups or different time of day that a group was engaging with us, but being able to respond to that and then create something that was going to work for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Hilary, and thank you to all of you. We've had a really, really interesting discussion on I guess how the arts and culture can address all kinds of challenges, whether it be with regard to conflict or identity, or wider societal issues, and we've really learned how I guess drawing from different aspects of the arts, or whether it be collaborating with other groups in our own areas or elsewhere on the island, how that can really benefit the kind of work that you're all doing. So thank you very, very much indeed to Linda, Hilary and Paula for joining us today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Across Divides. Learn more about today's topic and find opportunities to get involved at icommunityhub.org. iCommunity is a joint initiative of the Wheel and NICFA and is supported by the Northern Ireland Department for Communities, the Department of Foreign Affairs Reconciliation Fund, and the Shared Island Unit in the Department of the Taoiseach.